Okay, so what I want to do this morning is start, I think we bring the lights down, Craig. Start by walking you through how we understand stars. And I'm going to start by showing you some images of stars that are actively being formed. And I'm not going to spend too much time on our understanding of star formation. It's actually still something we don't understand well at all. And just for that reason, we've got a program here in the fall on the physics of star formation. And then I'll get into the pieces that we do understand reasonably well, which is how stars operate, the importance of what we call hydrostatic balance, which I'll remind you of, the importance of understanding what sets their brightness, what powers them, which all of you know is nuclear energy. And then I'll walk through how quantum mechanics really makes a difference for determining what kinds of stars become what as a function of the mass of the star. And so just to start off, this is a globular cluster in the background, 47 Tuck. Which is a cluster of stars in our galaxy, roughly a million stars with masses typically about that of the Sun. Sounds like they're mowing the lawn. So let me start with zooming in a little bit. So this is, just to give you a sense of, within our own galaxy, what's going on, this is a, what we call an open cluster, a region where stars are being formed that from understanding the stars we know are about 10 million years old. It's a few kiloparsecs away, so this is thousands of light years. And I'm going to zoom in as I go here, showing you different regions and show you a little bit about what's going on in star formation regions before I get into the details of the structure of stars themselves. So this is a large region light years across, and what you see are some very bright stars. And these, as I'll tell you, are the most massive stars that have been formed so far. But you also see there's some dark regions where actually there's still stars being formed. And if I zoom in to that, you can see very bright stars that are just being formed a few million years old. But you can also see there's still clouds of material. So these are called globules. These are clouds of material, typically 5 to 10 times the mass of the Sun, that have yet to collapse and form stars. And a textbook author I know had one of these images in his textbook, and when he got it back from the copy editor said, "You know, I took care of those blemishes." So you definitely need to train the copy editors about astronomy. Okay, this just zooms in to show some of these blemishes, shall we say. And you can really see that the reason it's dark is because it's full of what we call dust in astronomy, which is small grains of silicate or quite often graphite that obscures the stars either within or behind that region. And you can see that a little bit. There are some objects which are, if you will, punching through those regions due to the fact that they're bright enough that they can still get through. And if this were in real color, these would be much redder stars, just as when you look at the sunset through the Earth's atmosphere, it tends to be reddened. And these clouds are extremely opaque to the optical light. If we were looking in the infrared, these would be very bright because the heat comes out in the infrared. But you can see these are indeed something a copy editor would not like in their textbook. I'm going to do some equations in a minute, but since it's astrophysics, it's awfully hard to not show you all these images that you've paid dearly for with your tax dollars. These are images from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is called the Eagle Nebula, and actually there's a large, we have a large version of this in the stairwell. I'd encourage you, if you go upstairs, you'll see it. So this is from the Advanced Camera for Surveys on the Hubble Space Telescope, the one that unfortunately is not working any longer, and we'll see what happens when the astronauts go back up. But what I want to show you on this is you can see there's sort of this blue, you know, it appears to be luminescence, if you will. And it's because there's these bright stars, which you can see here, are actually such strong sources of ultraviolet radiation that they're causing this cloud to, if you will, evaporate. And so what you're seeing is material that's coming off of these regions due to the strong ultraviolet light. And what that is that the stars themselves, as they're forming, actually eat up or use up the cloud, of course, to make the stars. But we actually know that it's a very inefficient process in the sense that if I have 5 or 10 solar masses of material out of which I can form stars, maybe only one solar mass gets put into the star. The rest gets evaporated and sent back out. So it's a very inefficient process, and that's one of the things that the program that's coming is going to try to study. But you can see that we're learning a lot from these data, and again, this is just more of these very dense clouds starting to form in a region which is already cleared out. So if we were able to look back 10 million years ago, these four or five stars were in a region like this, okay? But the fact that they formed and started ionizing their cloud has basically sent that cloud away, and so now you can really reveal the stars. And that's what we see over time in these star-forming regions. Now, that process forms stars with masses up to about 100 solar masses. That's probably the most massive star that we know about, maybe even that's a little extreme, and down to very low masses. And what I need to explain to you is how we understand that. Now, here's one more picture, just because I can't help myself. This is from the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is what used to be called CERTIF. Since it launched successfully, it got the name of a theorist attached to it. And this is the Orion region, something you're probably very familiar with in the northern sky. This is near the belt, and this is just showing an very far infrared image, again showing a star-forming region. Now that's enough of the pretty pictures. What I want to do is start giving you a little bit of a sense of what's the challenge and what do we observe and how do we understand it. So many of you have probably seen this. This is what we call the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. This is, if I just look at stars in our galaxy, and I'll show you a real version of this. This is, if you will, the textbook version. What I want to explain to you is how we understand this diagram. So what's shown here are stars that are observed, and this is luminosity on this axis in solar units. So one is the sun. And this is surface temperature. And in astronomy, unfortunately, everything's plotted backwards. So the cold stars are to the right. So they have surface temperatures of 3,000 Kelvin. That's cold for astronomers. And the hottest stars are over here at 25,000 Kelvin. Okay? Now you might be familiar with the spectral class, which I'm not really going to focus on. Let's just keep this in physical units, which is the temperature. Okay? And of course, what I'm going to explain for you today is why is it the stars live on this certain track? And I'm not going to really talk too much about what we call giants and supergiants. So I will talk about these objects down here, the white dwarfs. But if you observe this, the real question is, what sets this dynamic range? Look at this. There's a factor of 10 to the 8 in luminosity of these stars. And the first question we want to ask is, what sets that? Why is there a factor of 10 to the 8? And what is the determining parameter? Is it the mass of the star? Is it the age of the star? What is the determining parameter for that? And I'll explain that for you. And of course, in temperature, you see there's only about a factor of 10 in temperature for these stars, surface temperature. Okay? So that's what I'm going to explain for you this morning, is what sets this dynamic range and how do we understand what's going on in these stars as well as those stars. So this is an updated version. This is a real version of real data. These are stars from Hipparchos, which was a satellite that is now, well, it's over 10 years ago. This was a satellite that measured very accurately the positions of stars on the sky. And of course, there's an effect called parallax, which is as you blink your eyes, of course, you get parallax. The way we use that is as the Earth goes around the sun, you take the images from those 6 months apart, and of course the nearby stars are moving relative to the background stars that are much further away. Okay, so you actually get a distance then to a huge amount of stars, huge numbers of stars. And if you have the distance, then you can get the absolute luminosity. And so what's plotted here is the absolute luminosity in astronomical units called magnitudes. This is increasing luminosity this way. So again, this is a factor of 100. So again, there's a factor of 100, another factor of 100. So again, there's sort of a factor of 10 to the 8 here. And then this is surface temperature, in this case just measured as the color. So these are blue stars, these are red stars, so the cooler stars are here. And again, this shows what I showed previously, which is that for nearby stars, they can't be just anywhere. They tend to really live in a certain strip. And so what I want to explain is why this is, what the controlling parameter is. I'll tell you now the controlling parameter is mass, just so you know. These are the massive stars, and these are the very low mass stars. How do these stars evolve in time, and what do they become? Now, originally, when this was first observed, astronomers thought that maybe this was age, and that the young stars started here, and as they aged, they became dim. I don't know why they would think that. And so unfortunately, that's why these are called early stars, and these are called late stars. Still, the jargon stays with us. And so if I slip into that, I'll try to avoid it. That's why I'll say early type and late type, but I should hopefully avoid it. So these are massive stars, and these are very low mass stars, and I'm going to explain why the luminosity is so dependent on the mass of the star. Okay. All right, so since I'm a theorist, I have to show you some equations. And what I want to do is give you just a few pieces of physics you actually need to understand this. It's actually not too much that you need to know. So if I'm sitting near the sun and I ask, how long does it take a sound wave to traverse the sun? It's a few hours for a sound wave to go through or around the sun. Okay? And I think we'll all agree that the sun has been there for more than a few hours. And therefore, there's plenty of time for what we call hydrostatic balance to have been established. Hydrostatic balance you're familiar with, which is the fact that as you go in water, the Earth's atmosphere, anything under gravity, the pressure rises. Right? So when I teach a course here called Physics in California, I always ask the students, you discover who's a scuba diver quickly, which is you ask, how deep do you have to go to have the pressure double? Somebody must know that. Yeah, exactly. Okay, we've got a diver. He knows it to two digits. So if you go 10 meters in water, you'll double the pressure. Okay, and that's what we call the hydrostatic balance equation, the fact that the pressure is rising as you go, in this case, dr going down, r is the radial coordinate, due to the density of water, if you will, over the density of the star, and the gravitational acceleration. Okay. So the thing to keep in mind for why is this number 10 meters? Well, that means that the amount of stuff in that 10 meters of water, let's do the water case first, is the same as the amount of stuff in the Earth's atmosphere from here to the top of the atmosphere. Okay, so that's about, just so you know, that's about the units I like to use, which is not pounds per square foot. That's about 1,000 grams per square centimeter. Okay, it's about a kilogram per square centimeter. That's how much stuff is in the Earth's atmosphere. And of course, that's the same because density of water is one. If you go down 10 meters in water, you get the same number. And so what matters when you're in hydrostatic balance is simply how much stuff is sitting on your head. That determines the pressure. Okay, so right now you're experiencing a high pressure zone. That's the weather we're having. And so there's actually a little bit more stuff above our head here than there was when you left the East Coast. But they're having a low pressure, and that gives you bad weather. This is not weather, by the way. This is just fog. That's what the real estate agents say. Okay, so the gravity is, of course, at any place in the star, just the gravitational constant, the mass inside of that radius divided by the radius squared. Okay. Now, I really say here we now cheat, and actually that's an important thing to know how to do, which is how do you take this equation and do it at the blackboard? Well, the way we cheat is we just say the pressure gradient across the star is, of course, the pressure at the center divided by the radius. That's that derivative. Okay. So those of you who teach mathematics should close your eyes for a moment. Okay. This is the density, is the typical density rho, and the gravitational acceleration is just g big M over r squared. Okay, so that gives us roughly what the pressure should be at the center of a star. And that star is held up with the pressure of just an ideal gas. That's what we're going to assume, in which case this is just the density in grams per cubic centimeter divided by the average mass, which I'm just going to set as mass of a proton. Just to remind you, typical star, it's 75% hydrogen, 25% helium. That's the composition, and a little bit of what we call in astronomy metals. Everything heavier than helium is a metal to an astronomer. Okay, and so this is just the ideal gas equation. That's all that is. Okay, so if I combine this pressure, which is that I'm going to hold the star up with ideal gas, with my expectation for what the pressure should be at the center of a star, I get a relationship between the temperature, KT, that's the thermal temperature of the star, and a piece that should look familiar, that's the gravitational binding energy. Okay? So this tells us that if I have the mass and the radius of a star, and it's being held up by an ideal gas pressure, I roughly know what the core temperature is. This is the temperature at the core, not the temperature at the surface. Okay? This is the temperature of most of the material. Okay? And so, I'm not worried about factors of 2 or 10 or pi. That's what I call cheating. I just want to get this for you to give you a sense for what's going on within a star, which is that basically the core temperature is completely determined by the mass divided by the radius. Okay? So how do I understand this? So this is my equation I've just quote-unquote derived for you. And now let's think about what it means. So as a star is formed, it's actually quite large in radius. It starts in that cloud. And what we observe is that those stars, over time, contract. Okay? And the reason they're contracting is because it's losing energy. And I'll derive for you the rate of that energy loss. It's losing energy to vacuum, and you can tell why it's losing energy. It's hot at the center, cold at the surface, so there's heat that's going out of the star. And I'll derive for you what the rate of that heat loss is. So it starts as a very large object. So the sun started as an object that was easily a factor of 100 times larger than it is today. And as it loses energy, it shrinks. Okay? As it shrinks, R decreases, and the core temperature rises. Okay? So the counterintuitive thing that stars do, at least counterintuitive to your normal daily experience, is as it loses energy, the temperature rises. Okay? So why is that? Well, you have a problem you know that's like that, which is the Kepler problem. If I have a particle orbiting, right? Remember, I'm always balancing kinetic energy of the motion with the gravitational potential. If it loses energy, it gets deeper in the potential well. If it gets deeper in the potential well, it's moving faster. Okay? So that is that's a correct analog to this problem. This is a star that is in hydrostatic balance, where it's balancing kinetic energy against gravitational potential energy. And so as it contracts, it is losing energy, it's getting deeper in its own potential well, and the temperature is rising. Okay? So these stars start off with core temperatures that are maybe only 10 to the 5 Kelvin, and as time goes by, as we'll see, something like the sun today has a temperature at the core of about 10 million Kelvin. Okay? So the energy source for that luminosity coming out is the fact that the material is slowly contracting in the potential well. That's the energy source. It's the gravitational energy of contraction. It's just, I dropped this, but in my break, you all know this energy, which is just the fact that I'm falling, if you will, except it's not really falling. It's slowly doing it. But it's moving within the gravitational potential to deeper into the well. So if there's no energy source other than gravitational energy, these stars will just contract forever. Okay? And if we took the sun today and asked, what is that time scale? This is what's called the Kelvin time of the star. It's the gravitational energy of the star, which is just gm squared over r. That's the gravitational total amount of gravitational energy divided by its current luminosity. That time scale would be roughly 10 million years. Okay? So the state of our knowledge in astrophysics before we understood how to tap into nuclear energy was that there was a serious problem. Because if the energy source for the sun was gravitational contraction, it should be changing its radius on a timescale of 10 million years by a factor of 2. Right? And that's a problem because we know that the age of the Earth is from radionuclide dating is around 5 billion years. So there was a problem. Right? The problem was, why wasn't the sun contracting? Or more importantly, what was the energy source for the sun? So the thing to keep in mind with stars is that so far, I've already told you that they're holding themselves up due to just hydrostatic pressure. That sets the core temperature. And they're losing energy just because they're hot in the middle. I haven't had to use any nuclear physics yet. That's the simplest thing to understand about stars is that they radiate perfectly fine without nuclear energy. They're hot without nuclear energy. The problem with them is they would just have a very short life. Okay? And so you can see what's going to happen is this contraction just keeps going until the temperature gets hot enough for fusion reactions to kick in and sort of save the day for the star. Okay, so this plot is very busy. I'm going to show it to you 4 times, and each time I'm going to just point out something different. So we just have to start first in the left-hand part, right here. That's all we have to do right now. Okay? So this shows the temperature and the density in the core of a star. That's what these trajectories are. That relation I derive, which is kT is gm over r, I can rewrite in terms of the density because I know the density is m over r cubed. And so I can rewrite that as the core temperature in units of the core density. Okay? And there's a scaling here with the mass. This is the mass in solar units. This is the density in the units we use, CGS, not MKS. And this goes to the density of the one-third. So this is the expectation if a star is under hydrostatic balance as to how its core temperature changes with its core density for a given mass. Okay? So this is a log-log plot, and so this T goes as rho to the one-third is actually my red line, and these are calculations of real stars as they contract, as they're contracting. So here's a one solar mass star contracting. Here's a seven solar mass star contracting, a 15 solar mass star contracting. And you see that at a given density, the more massive stars should be hotter, and they are, as this relation predicts. So this is just from hydrostatic balance. That's all this is. And this is what we call this pre-main sequence contraction. It's just the contraction of the star that basically, if there's no nuclear physics, this is all that would happen. And the sun would be done in 10 million years. Okay. Now, you see there's a line on here, which I have to sort of explain to you, and I will, which is when we burn hydrogen. There's another line when we burn helium. There's another line when we burn carbon. And I'll walk you through this this morning. But basically, the thing to keep in mind is that these stars, all they want to do is keep losing energy and contracting. And basically, the nuclear physics slows it down, but the ultimate fate is complete contraction because they're constantly losing energy. Okay. So how do I get the stellar luminosity? Well, this I skipped a few steps, but let me at least give you a sense for it. So again, this is my core temperature. I have a mass and a radius, and that's my core temperature. And of course, the core is hot and the surface is cold. It's basically vacuum. Now, in your house, of course, the heat gets out. But it doesn't do it in the way a star does it. The way a star does it is what we call radiative diffusion. It's the fact that there is a slight amount of radiation pressure in these stars. That's given by AT to the fourth, the pressure due to the photons. And the photons have a mean free path, L, which is actually much longer. And they move very fast, of course. They move at the speed of light. So the heat transport is via radiative diffusion, photons diffusing through. In a piece of metal, heat transport is by the electrons as they try to transport heat. And stars, that's not as efficient as the radiation. And so the heat flux, this is what you might call Fick's law. You might have heard of Fick's law, which is just what's the heat flux for a given amount of material. It just tells us that this is the speed of the particles, their mean free path, and the gradient, the change from the center to the surface of AT to the fourth. Well, T, you can see, depends to high power on the mass and the radius. And when you work this through, this literally, this, with this input, you find that the luminosity of the star is proportional to the mass cubed. Okay? And the radius cancels. I didn't put in all the steps, but actually if you follow this through with the mean free path and the radius here, and this is the flux, so you multiply that by 4 pi r squared, you'll find the luminosity is independent of the radius, it just goes as the mass cubed. Okay? So now I've already explained for you why there's such a large dynamic range in those luminosities. That dynamic range of luminosities comes from the fact that the star's luminosity is a high power of its mass. And the mass, as we know from other measurements, has a dynamic range of roughly 0.08, which I have to explain, up to maybe 50. Okay? So this is how we understand why these stars have a large range in luminosity. It has to do with just the fact that the more massive stars are hotter, and because there's a T to the fourth in the heat transport, they have much more heat loss than a low mass star. Okay. So again, what I haven't explained is what sets the stellar radius. What is it that stops the contraction of these stars? Because of this luminosity, they're constantly contracting. And I need to explain that. Before I do that, I want to stop for a moment. When you're all teachers, so you know you have to stop now and again and blow something up or show a picture. Since we don't have any demonstrations here, I used to use the Tesla coil. That really works. So this is just to give you a sense again for some of these bright stars. So again, this is just another region of star formation in our galaxy. And again, you can see these bright stars are evaporating these clouds. And those bright stars, because of that luminosity being such a high power of mass, some of the bright stars die before the low mass stars even have contracted. Right? Because of this M cubed, the high mass stars burn out very fast and quite often even blow themselves up to supernovae before the low mass stars have even contracted a factor of 2. Okay? So you have this huge dynamic range in the time scales of over which stars live. Okay, so what stops the contraction? Why is it that these stars, the sun, doesn't just keep collapsing on a 10 million year time scale? So we had to find a more robust energy source, and that ended up basically the only way we could understand that was using quantum mechanics to allow for tunneling. So at the temperatures, so we knew, I wasn't born, but it was known at the time that the stars, the core temperature was basically known because of that, all that physics I told you. It was very clear that the core temperature was around 10 million Kelvin. Okay, that energy scale, just to give you a sense, is only about 10 kilovolts, whereas if I take two protons and put them very close to each other, roughly that's an energy of an MeV, a factor of 1,000 higher. So the puzzle, the physics puzzle at the time, was how can you possibly get any fusion reactions at these temperatures, right? And the only way that was understood was using the fact that quantum mechanics allows you to tunnel underneath that barrier with some very low probability to undergo a fusion reaction. And so that's the, once quantum mechanics was in hand, this was shown, well, it still took 20 years to figure this out, but basically shown what the chain was, which is two protons coming together to form deuterium, emitting a positron and a neutrino. That deuterium then very quickly captures another proton to form helium-3. And then as you build up helium-3 in the star, you have helium-3, helium-3 going to helium-4 and two protons. So it's sort of, there's an extra step here. I'm not showing how I made the two helium-3s, but if you count, if we did the counting correctly, basically what you'd find is that I used up four protons, two of them converted to neutrons here at this step, and then I, after that, basically formed helium-4. So I'm converting hydrogen protons to helium. Okay, that's the fusion energy, and that is giving me about 7 MeV per proton. That the binding energy of helium is 28 MeV, and so that's the energy source. Okay? Now that quantum tunneling ends up putting in a very exponentially sensitive temperature sensitivity to the reaction rates. Okay? And so what happens is, and I'll show you that in a moment, is that basically you quickly reach, once you reach a certain core temperature, those reactions kick right in, start generating energy, generate just enough energy to match the losses to vacuum, in which case the star says, okay, I actually do not need to contract any longer. I can live at this fixed radius and be in a balance where my nuclear energy is being generated at exactly the rate at which the luminosity is leaving the star. That's what we call the main sequence. That fixes the stellar radius, because remember, the core temperature knows about the mass to the radius, so if I fix the core temperature, I'm fixing the radius of the star. Okay, and then how long does it live? Well, it lives there while it's burning its fuel. Okay, so it will live for a time which is set by the total nuclear energy available, which is proportional to the mass of the star, divided by its luminosity, which is proportional to the mass cubed. And so the lifetime will be, I'm scaling it to the sun, right, roughly 10 gigayears, and it goes like 1 over m squared. Okay, so as they say, brightest stars have the shortest lives, so not unlike Hollywood. And so massive stars, again, because they have a very high luminosity, have to burn their fuel very fast. Okay. And you can see how different these are. Again, we've got a factor of roughly 100 in the masses of stars. And so there's a factor here of 10 to the 4 in the amount of time that they need to burn their fuel. Okay. So again, I'm going to show this plot. So again, the core temperature, remember, is proportional to the mass of the radius. Burning is very temperature sensitive. So what I'm going to assume for now is that roughly there's a magic temperature at which you burn, in which case the radius of a star when it's burning should be proportional to its mass. They all have, if they all have the same core temperature. Okay. Now they don't quite. Here's where they burn. The more massive stars need to be a little bit hotter, 3 by 10 to the 7. The low mass stars burn at 10 to the 7, so there's a factor of 3 here, which I'm not going to worry about too much. But this is what we call the hydrogen burning main sequence, which is they stop and they sit here burning their fuel. That's what the sun's doing. It's halfway done. But some stars do it much more rapidly. The lowest mass star, which I have to explain, that can actually do this is 0.08 solar masses. And there's a piece of physics that sets that, which I'll explain. So that's the main sequence. So I haven't gotten that far, but basically you now should understand the theme, which is these stars are losing energy constantly, and basically their only hope is using up the fuel they've got, and the fast ones use it up more rapidly. So if we look at an open cluster, this is the Pleiades cluster. And so, as I say, the massive, most luminous stars burn their fuel fastest. So if you look at all the stars are born on the same day, and you stand back and watch, what you'll see is the massive stars die first. Okay? And so you can always find the most massive star in a star-forming region, and that basically tells you roughly what the age is from this theoretical discussion I just gave you, gives you what the age is of that cluster. Okay, so in the Pleiades, that's about 120 million years, and that's how we actually get the age of these clusters, is we see no stars brighter than something, and we're hoping that they're always populating all masses. So that's a little subtle, but that's just how you get the age. Right? So that cluster I showed you at the very beginning, 47 Tuck, and I'll show you another cluster in a minute, of these globular clusters, you do the same exercise and you find that the age of the cluster is maybe 12 billion years old. Now, who knows the age of the universe? 13.7. Okay, so when I started in astrophysics, which was longer ago than I care to admit, the number was, 5 or maybe 12. That was the state of our understanding from cosmology. Okay? Now, from stars, we knew that was a problem because we think we understand stellar evolution well enough to know that these globular clusters are between 10 and 12 gigayears old. And you don't want to find a globular cluster older than the age of the universe. Okay? And so, in stellar astrophysics, we've known for 40 years that the age of the universe probably was in excess of 10 or 11. Okay? The big breakthrough, of course, was the understanding from studying the microwave background that you can get an age of the universe from the microwave background plus the Hubble constant, and you get this accurate number now of 13.7. Okay? I'm happy to report that there was no star known older than that. Okay? And so actually our understanding was in pretty good shape. There is still an offset between the age of the universe and the age of the oldest star. And that we roughly understand is the fact that stars don't form at time zero. You've got to wait for the material to become dense enough and form galaxies, and there's some time delay associated with that. But it's still an active area of study, and I'll show you a globular cluster where people are actually still working on this question. Okay, so I'm almost done with the mathematics, but I haven't explained everything. Why stop when you're doing so well? Okay, so we've got the luminosity. I've explained that dynamic range. Okay, what I haven't explained is why the surface temperature only has roughly a factor of 8. Why is that? Okay, well, now you can do this. So you can say you can do this at home. Okay, so here's the luminosity of the star. Hopefully I got this right. 4 pi r squared sigma t to the fourth. Okay, but I've told you the luminosity is proportional to the mass cubed, right? And I've also said that the radius, if I'm on the main sequence and I'm burning hydrogen, which is what these stars are doing, the radius is roughly proportional to the mass. Okay, so this goes as the mass squared. That's T effective to the fourth. So I get T effective to the fourth proportional to mass, or T effective is proportional to the mass to the 1/4. Okay. And so it's weakly dependent on the mass of the star, the surface temperature. This is what we call the surface temperature. It's this definition. There is material at this temperature on the surface, but it's really a definition. The luminosity is the fundamental parameter. The radius is the fundamental parameter. It allows me to define something which has the units of temperature. But it's actually even more or less right. Stars aren't black bodies. I can tell you that. I showed you spectrum. They wouldn't look like black bodies. The only thing that's a good black body is a microwave background. Okay, so this is why the massive stars are up here, but they're also blue. They're hotter surface temperature. Okay. That's very important, and that's why I've drawn this as a blue line. Okay. Because when we look at galaxies, we see this. We see this phenomena that the massive, bright, massive stars have a surface temperature that's bluer, that gives off more ultraviolet radiation than these stars that are red, sitting here at this very cold temperature of 3,000 Kelvin, barely doing anything. So here's an example of that. Here's an image from the Hubble Space Telescope of distant galaxies. And here's a region where, and this is in quote-unquote true color. Let's not worry about what that means. Okay, here's a star-forming galaxy with young blue stars, okay? Because they're the bright stars, so they dominate everything when you're forming stars. And then here's an old galaxy, forget this arc, that's a gravitational lens effect. It's real, but let's not worry about it here. This is an elliptical, what we call an elliptical galaxy, where star formation ended 10 gigayears ago. So all that's left are really old low-mass stars, things lower mass than the Sun, and it's red. Okay, and so you can actually tell, just in galaxies, whether the star is being formed, because the only stars that are around, if it's being formed, are these really bright, massive stars. The low-mass stars are there, but you just can't see them. They're totally swamped by the light from these bright, massive stars. Okay. So why don't all stars do this? Why doesn't Jupiter, which just remember is 10 to the minus 3, the mass of the Sun, why isn't it burning hydrogen? Okay. Why don't all stars get to have this experience? Okay. Well, what happens is, again, another effect of quantum mechanics comes in, which is that eventually if I get very dense and I'm cold, so for a given density, if I'm cold, what happens is the electrons, of course, are quantum mechanical particles. They have what we call the de Broglie wavelength, which is, if you will, the uncertainty principle's way of telling us how well we can localize that particle given its momentum. And eventually, if you get dense enough, that localization distance is the same as the separation of the particle. Okay? So that's when the electrons first, if you will, learn that they're quantum mechanical, which is that they say, uh-oh, I have a problem here. I can't occupy the same state. There's another particle adjacent to me, which is an electron. And we can flip our spins and be okay, but we can't get more than two of us in the same state. At that point, if you keep compressing the material, it actually doesn't heat up. The electrons do increase their momentum, but it doesn't affect the temperature. And this is what we call degeneracy pressure. And this is actually what's holding up, you know, this piece of table is balanced between degeneracy pressure of the electrons and Coulomb physics. But that Pauli exclusion principle basically forces these electrons to have more and more energy as the density increases, in which case the temperature does no longer has to rise. So it's a little subtle, but it actually is what determines everything for stars, is that this happens for different masses, for different stars, and I'll show that. So basically the way to think of this is that there becomes a density at which, if I keep compressing it, it no longer needs to heat up to hold itself up. The degenerate electrons can hold up that star, and the temperature does not have to rise. So there is a maximum temperature for any mass star. Okay? And for hydrogen burning, if I don't get hot enough, I just won't burn. And so that mass to burn hydrogen is above about 0.08 solar masses. And so lower mass stars, they just cool forever. They never ignite their hydrogen. They never are able to tap this energy source. Okay? But they don't keep collapsing because they end up holding themselves up with these degenerate electrons. That's what's holding, that's the pressure support. So Jupiter is sitting there with a radius of about a tenth of a solar radius. It's still losing a little bit of energy, but it's not going to change its radius at all. It's done contracting, but it's still losing energy. So there is luminosity coming out of Jupiter due to the fact that it was born 5 gigayears ago, but it's not a big effect. So let me show you some of this. This is a 12 billion year old globule cluster, NGC 6397. Again, this is just an image from the ground of this. There was a very deep Hubble observation done of this cluster about a year ago by Harvey Richards' group at UBC in Vancouver. So this is an image of HST. Now, it's unfortunate you can't really see it. Usually, if you look at a globule cluster, you know, with a camera from the ground, you can't see through it. Now, that's not because it's dense with stars. It's because the Earth's atmosphere, of course, blurs the image and spreads the light out. Well, with Hubble, of course, because you don't have the Earth's atmosphere, you can see right through it. So it's kind of a fun image. You can see, here's a galaxy. You can see in the background. So it's kind of exciting. Now, what they've highlighted here are a few objects. So here's an object which is the faintest hydrogen-burning star sitting there, which they know is in that cluster. Here's what we call a white dwarf, which I'm going to explain in the last few minutes, showing you how well they can get these. But the most amazing thing for me is seeing this. So with Hubble, you get such accurate positions that, so here's the problem. The problem is you're trying to see this globular cluster. There's stars in our galaxy between us and the globular cluster. Okay. However, that globular cluster is moving as a unit, whereas everything between us and there is moving randomly. Okay. So if you can measure very accurate positions, then over time, if you wait long enough, you can differentiate the stars in the cluster from the stars in the foreground because they move together. Okay? So this is the brightness of the star on this axis. This is the color. So again, red is to the right. So here's the red stars. Brightness is to the top. So this is everything between this is everything you see in the image. Okay? Now if you wait a few years, you could see that those objects have moved, and you can clean that up and get this, which is just the stars in the cluster. So this is, you know, I showed you these versions of this main sequence diagram with a lot of scatter and it looked really bad. You say, well, you know, stars they're not behaving well. Well, here it is. I mean, this is quite amazing. Now you might, and these stars are all in the cluster. Okay? So now you should ask, well, wait a minute, what is that? You know, what are these guys here? So look at this, they're brighter than they should be for their color. These are really in the cluster. Does anybody want to guess what those are? No? No? Binaries. Right? If you look on the sky, half the stars you see are binaries. Okay? Now in a cluster, you'd say, well, if that's true, then there should be a whole sequence of binaries, but they're not there. Well, in a cluster, actually, there's so much dynamics going on in a globular cluster that you use up the binaries. So you actually have enough interactions that you break up the binaries. So there's actually a small binary fraction in these clusters. So you get this very clean main sequence. Okay. And then down here, you start getting some noise just because you're at very, these are 20, you know, so for those who do astronomy, this is roughly a red filter. This is 25th magnitude. Okay. Here's 27th magnitude. So these are really faint stars, right? Your naked eye, if you're lucky, you can see down to 5th magnitude. Okay. With binocular, maybe you can go to, well, I don't want to guess what you can do with the binoculars. But basically, these are very faint stars. So down here, you start getting some noise. This is the hydrogen burning limit. This would be the faintest star possible at the hydrogen burning limit. And you might notice there's nothing down here. Right? Well, that's what we expect. Those stars have cooled forever. They're just off the plot. Then you also see a beautiful sequence of what we call white dwarfs, which I'll explain in the time I've got remaining, which are the remnants of these stars. So this is the main sequence. By far, in terms of data set, the most beautiful, you know, to an astronomer, beautiful. Beautiful main sequence you've ever seen because it's so cleaned up. And it really tells us that we're on the right track. Except I should say, by the way, no theorist can make a curve that agrees with this data, okay? So they've jumped forward of us at this point. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes, I just want to keep going, but you can see where we're headed. Hydrogen, you get most energy from hydrogen and helium. That gives you 7 MeV. From going from helium to iron, the most stable isotope, you only get another 2 MeV. So basically, most of the, you know, you've gotten most of your bang just getting to helium. Okay. The other thing that happens is, for other reasons, the stars actually get brighter as they evolve. They burn up their fuel faster. So most of the star's life is burning hydrogen. But you can see what happens. These stars finish burning hydrogen. They run out of fuel. They say, fine, I'm still losing energy. I better tap my gravitational energy again. So they contract. So they just keep going. They contract yet again. Until, guess what, they get hot enough to burn helium. And that reaction is complicated because beryllium-8 is not a stable isotope. If you take two helium-4s and make beryllium-8, it's unstable. It just decays back, so it doesn't really work. And so it took a while for the astronomy community to figure that one out. But now we know it makes carbon and oxygen in the stellar core. Okay, and then it contracts and it hits this line. This is that line of degeneracy. Okay, so I showed you that relationship of degeneracy. If we bring this degeneracy line down and bring this hydrogen ignition line down, they intersect around here. So if I drew on here a Jupiter, it would go up and then it would turn around and come down. That's the Jupiter trajectory. It's the maximum temperature. And you can start to see that for these stars. These massive, here's a 7 solar mass star, burns, becomes degenerate. Because it becomes degenerate, no longer needs to heat up, and now it drops and it cools and it never gets to burn its carbon. Okay? So the simple statement is this goes like density to the two to the I'm going to get the signs wrong density to the two-thirds which is less steep. Sorry, I'm going to get the signs wrong. There's two different density scalings. I'm not going to try to do it real time, but you can see what happens is these curves intersect the degeneracy depending on their mass at different temperatures. So this guy intersects way up here, therefore he gets to burn his carbon. The low mass stars intersect down here. They don't even get to burn their hydrogen. It's just that intersection of those two curves that determines the fate of all the stars. Okay, so what happens to these stars? Well, this is what the sun will do. all stars less than 6 to 8 make carbon and oxygen. They make a white dwarf, what we call a white dwarf, which is a carbon-oxygen object. The mass that's small, radius of the Earth. Densities of these are about 1 million times the density of water. But you might notice there's a problem here. I'm not adding my numbers correctly. I'm losing somehow 4 or 5 solar masses. Well, here it is. That's that star at the very end of its life, when it's a giant, or actually a supergiant, sends out a wind that we would call slow. It's only a few kilometers per second. Bob, and you'll hear about higher speeds from Ed and Bob when they talk about supernovae. That wind goes out, and as the white dwarf contracts and becomes a very strong ultraviolet source, it gets to light up the nebula of all the material it sent out. And so there's the young white dwarf right in the center. This is what we call a planetary nebula. It has absolutely nothing to do with planets, but that's what we call it. And these are just way cool. Here's another one from Spitzer and Hubble. Here's the white dwarf. It's a strong UV source. It's lighting up all this matter it sent out in this wind. And there's a lot of very interesting hydrodynamic instabilities here. You can see sort of fingers coming in. Not really the topic for this, but basically all this matter goes out. And most of this matter had very little burning. So most of this is just hydrogen and helium. Sat on the star, didn't get to burn, and got sent back out. So it actually was not really efficient at actually doing anything for us in terms of chemical evolution of the galaxy, of making elements. Okay, and this just shows their final mass as a function of their initial mass. And indeed, we have this relation pretty well now. One solar mass, like the Sun, will make a 0.5. 7 solar mass will make a 1 solar mass white dwarf. And the rest of that mass just goes out in these slow winds. Okay. So what are the outcomes so far? So the low mass stars never get hot enough. If I'm between 0.08 and 0.8, I burn hydrogen to helium. After 12 gigayears, it's such a slow burner. They're still burning. So a 0.5 solar mass star just keeps burning. And we usually don't talk about stellar evolution for those because they don't evolve in the age of the universe. So it's that's purely an academic problem. Doesn't mean physicists don't do it. And then, as I said, stars from between 0.8 and 6, they get to burn hydrogen to helium and helium to carbon, and they leave a compact remnant. Okay? Now, as I said, the most massive stars, for roughly between above, let's say, 8 solar masses, if they start burning, they just get to go all the way to iron, at least in their core. Okay? If you get to iron, now you're done. This is the peak in the binding energy curve, and you can do no more. And so that object then just keeps collapsing. And that actually forms supernovae. So let me show you what that looks like. So here's what the star would look like before the collapse. It's got a ball of iron at the center, 1.3 solar masses. We can add this up and figure out what mass star it is in a minute. So there's a silicon shell, an oxygen shell, a carbon shell, a helium shell, and then stuff that hasn't burned yet at the surface. So I guess it's a 15 solar mass star. This iron ball collapses. Okay? The density here is so much higher that this star doesn't even get to respond to that collapse. It just collapses. And what happens is the star finds out when a shock wave suddenly comes out through this material. That's the signal that gets sent to the star saying, you've got a problem. Your core, your rug's just been pulled out from underneath you. And that shock sends all this material out into the interstellar medium, silicon, oxygen, carbon, helium. This is where these elements are primarily made. Is they're made in this furnace and this onion skin, and then they get sent out. And that leaves behind a remnant at the core, which is either a neutron star or a black hole. Okay? And we still debate what determines that, and that we don't understand. You see these as supernovae. So here's a spiral galaxy. Here's one of these popping off as what's called a type 2 supernovae. There's this bright object. Here's I don't know. It's either a pre or a post image. Maybe one of the supernovae people knows. This is how we enumerate supernovae. It was found in 05. And you can ask Bob Kirshner about the scheme. You start with the big A, and then you run out of the alphabet, and then you say, uh-oh, we're finding too many supernovae. We'll call them, I think, little AA. Is that right, Ed? Okay, and then it goes A, B, A, C. It's really a nightmare. Okay, it's in a nearby Messier object. Here is the Crab Nebula. This is a supernovae that went off in our galaxy in 1054 AD. This is showing all of that stuff that got sent out, all the silicon, calcium, all this great stuff. This is the X-ray overlay from the Chandra X-ray Observatory, another working observatory named after a theorist, Chandra Sekhar. Okay, it's actually an interesting phenomenon. The ones that work are named after theorists. So far, so good. And there's a neutron star in there, the Crab Pulsar, spinning at 33 milliseconds. That's one rotation. neutron stars have a radius of 10 kilometers and roughly the mass of the sun. Okay? So they have an average density that's the same as the density of a nucleus of an atom. Okay? If we zoom in with Chandra and look at that, I'm going to leave you with this. This is what you see. These are real images. I didn't make these up. Okay, here's the neutron star, which you can't resolve. Right? There appears to be a jet of stuff coming out because this guy's spinning rapidly with a magnetic field. There's a torus of material, and this is showing that over time, these things change. Right? This is changing in brightness. This is all changing in brightness. And these are X-rays from basically fast relativistic particles that are being sent off from this neutron star that's spinning there at 33 milliseconds. And so we've still got some serious mysteries left to study. And at that point, I'll stop for questions. Thanks. We're supposed to use a mic. Which mic do you have? Oh, here we go. Okay. So we just start. Whoever's got to raise your hand for. Yeah, I can.
That was a great talk, first of all.
Thank you.
Secondly, I'm curious, since you would imagine that a collapsing object like the ones you described is spherical,
yes.
What makes a neutron star start spinning?
Okay, so there's two things in astrophysics we usually don't talk about, but we should. One is rotation, what you're asking, the other is magnetic field. Okay, because in a spherical code, I don't know what to do. Right? That's the bad answer. The good answer is that the rotation is very important to the evolution of these stars. We measure rotation in young stars. The sun, of course, rotates in about 30 days. We think it was born much more rapidly rotating. But because of the solar wind and the fact that those go out on magnetic field lines, that gives you a lever arm as the matter leaves that allows the sun to lose angular momentum and spin down with time. So when we look at very late times in stellar evolution, we're now seeing the neutron star spin sitting at 33 milliseconds, there's no way we can actually predict what those spin periods should be at birth. Because there's so much opportunity for angular momentum transport within the star, never mind off into the vacuum, that basically we're completely dependent on observations to provide us with guidance of that rotational state. And probably Ed might talk about it, that there's sort of expectations that rapid rotation can really lead to more dramatic types of collapses. In gamma ray bursts. I think Ed will probably talk about that. But the short answer is, you know, all we know is what we observe. In terms of rotation, we don't have a good theoretical understanding. But there is a high expectation that everything should be rotating.
Just a follow-up question and related to your last slide. The magnetic field orientation and the spin on that last slide, can you show that again?
In that case, the magnetic, it's a dipole field, as far as we can tell, and it's misaligned from the spin axis. And that jet you saw coming out, that's on the spin axis, actually, we think. Okay. And the equatorial stuff is on the spin. So the equatorial belt that looks like a belt there is also is in the toroidal plane. Is in the rotational, So we think this is the spin axis, and this is in the equator.
I think you said the sun started out about 100 times the size it is now.
Easily, yeah.
And that would be out close to where the Earth is.
You
so
bet.
Why are we not part of the sun?
So as the stars contract. They definitely, because of this question of angular momentum, there's a lot of material that has too much angular momentum to join the star. And so there's always matter left in a disk around the star. So if we look at very young stars, you can actually see now from Spitzer and even from Hubble, the evidence for disks around those stars. And out of that disk, as a star now has gone to smaller radii, out of that disk, planets form. And so the expectation is for most of these stars is, I mean, this is the reason we believe most stars should have planets, is that there's always some debris disk left behind due to angular momentum, due to the fact that matter is rotating too quickly. Microphone? Yeah, take the mic to whoever. Yeah. Hand it or something, yeah.
Hello. I was just wondering, what would determine whether or not at this point, we would get a neutron star or a black hole?
Okay, it's a great question. So there's a maximum mass I can make for a neutron star, and that depends on my ability to understand the equation of state, the pressure-density relationship of this very dense nuclear matter. And that, we think, is roughly around 2 solar masses. Okay? So if out of that collapsing object, it's sent, so what happens is that object collapses, the iron ball collapses, that much we understand. It then sends out neutrinos, most of that energy comes out as neutrinos, and those are observed from a nearby supernova in the Magellanic Clouds in 1987, 1987A was the name of that supernova. So we know you have this collapse. Now, that collapse happens. Then what happens, as I said, is the star says, oh my floor's fallen out from under me. So the star starts to try to accrete, if you will, onto that core. And there's that interaction of the accretion with the outgoing shock completely determines whether it collapses or who wins is the question. And so on the theoretical side, for many years, we couldn't even get the thing to explode. You get the whole thing to collapse. And if the whole thing collapses, then you form a black hole. So it totally has to do with how much of that star ends up collapsing back before the shock that's going out can eject it. And this is still an active theoretical problem. And so we don't know. We know we have black holes between 5 and 8 solar masses, for sure. We see them in binaries in our own galaxy. So we know you can make black holes somehow. But if I ask whether it's a 20 solar mass star or 30, I would claim we don't really know from the theoretical side, and observationally either.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead on this side. Yeah.
You know, I've always made the assumption that when I think of a red star, that it's because of temperature, it's giving off greater amount of photons and the red wavelengths, and that as you got to hotter stars, then the color, of course, changes.
Yeah.
But I've always been curious as to why isn't there like green stars or violet stars, or why are white stars cooler than blue stars on the main sequence?
Well, this is one I love to have an observer answer the question. I didn't come up with these terms. So, you know, the astronomical nomenclature of colors is set by one star. Does anybody know who that star is? Nope. Vega. Okay, so colors in the astronomical units, a star of zero color has exactly the same color as Vega. Now you might say, well, and? You know, Vega's 10,000 Kelvin, roughly, we now know. And so whether stars are red or blue is relative to Vega, because it's a comparison star. So everything was sort of defined on a relative scale, just like the magnitude scale is a completely relative scale, set by the fact that at dark, your eye is a logarithmic detector. And so the units are logarithmic units. So I'm not answering your question, really, as to why we call, you know, so blue or red is relative to Vega. And so if a star is red, that means it's colder than 10,000 Kelvin. If it's blue, then it's bluer than it's hotter than 10,000 Kelvin. You know, white, and I don't know. Can Ed answer white? Why we call things white? Maybe Ed wants to answer. No. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, looking at the main sequence, usually yes. Stars evolve off that. To get yes. to a white dwarf, they usually go through a giant phase.
Correct.
Looking at glob cluster,
yep.
Where is it?
Oh, so in that glob cluster with Hubble, those giants are a real problem because they saturate the detector. So they're not on that curve.
So you're dumping them out. So they're up there.
You bet.
They're
and,
off.
And,
okay.
and some, I can't tell you which, but I'd be willing to bet that like this object and this object, you know, these are probably red giants.
They're the giants in that phase.
That are, right? That are there. That they just had to, and you can see them more in this image, I think. Yeah, so these are probably red giants, some of these.
Okay.
Yeah, they're
there. Then the second question I have is on your log plot of temperature yeah. and pressure. That's a yeah. continuous behavior in terms of the masses you're running from.
Yeah.
So this is, it's almost like a continuous spectrum in the lower left-hand side where you've got stars that evolve into the hydrogen ignition.
Mm-hmm. So this is a one solar mass star. This is the trajectory in time. As it's collapsing, its core is getting denser and hotter, denser and hotter, and denser and hotter. And then it gets to here, this is a solar sun, and it gets to burn hydrogen for a finite time. It changes here because of the composition change, because of the compositional issue. The ideal gas is different if it's mostly helium instead of mostly hydrogen. Who's got the microphone? Just give it to somebody with their hand up. Yeah. Start there.
You'll have to forgive me. I've just been teaching astronomy for a short time, and this is my first time here. But I understand that when stars begin to collapse, to form, or the hydrogen begins to collapse, that there's a stage where, like you showed at the beginning, the globules, where they're dark.
Yeah, right.
And that we don't quite understand why, you know, they have to be cool for a certain period of time,
right.
And we're looking for why that doesn't occur. Maybe there's more water in space or something like that. So,
yeah.
You know.
What you're asking, I think, what triggers the initial collapse out of that cloud.
And why, you know, it's cooler, or why they maintain that temperature so that,
right.
And we can't quite determine with our technology. I know there may be more stars out there because they are older, that we can't quite see, and we have this
right.
problem of the missing matter, and
okay.
now we've detected some younger, or some older galaxies little by little, and so
yeah.
I was just wondering if, you know, there possibly, if there are some, you know, globules and some, because you're saying that, you know, there are some younger galaxies that are blue, as well
yeah.
as some, you know, some stars that are living fast and furious that are
yeah.
also, you know, very, very young. So older stars, and so, you know, that's
so
what
I
was wondering.
I think you've asked three questions.
Yeah, kind of, in a way, sorry. I did have a couple.
That's good, that's good.
Okay.
That's good.
Sorry, trying to get them all in there.
I'll start with one. So there was a time where we thought there's something called, well, if you look at what we call the rotation curve of a galaxy, and you measure the velocity of rotation in a galaxy, distant galaxy, imagine it's edge-on, you can measure the velocity of motion. If you measure that velocity as a function of radius, what you see is it's flat. And if you look at the light in the galaxy, it's dropping off really dramatically. So if the mass followed the light, the stars, then you'd expect as you go further and further out, just like Kepler orbits, the velocity should drop. And that's not observed in the galaxy.
Right.
And that's evidence for what we call dark matter.
Right.
Great name, because you don't see it. And for many years, we thought that could be low-mass stars, Jupiters, et cetera, et cetera. We now basically know from many different lines of evidence, including searches within our own galaxy, that that's not true, that dark matter cannot be baryons, it can't be hydrogen, it can't be helium, it can't be low-mass Jupiters. It has to be some particle, some microscopic particle, for which we don't have an explanation.
I know some people that are doing like some gravitational lensing experiments,
yes.
and
yes.
that
it's
you know
direct
like
evidence
that.
For the dark matter from gravitational lensing, because it does give you a potential. And so that lens I showed, there was an image I had that showed that effect here. It's an elliptical galaxy. There's dark matter in that galaxy. This is a lensed background star-forming galaxy that is lensed by the potential well of the dark matter, okay? And the only way you can understand that lens is you have to have dark matter. You cannot explain it by just using the potential generated by the star.
And yet I just read something about that there aren't any shadows being cast and so by the galaxies, and so then
yep.
there's a big problem with this whole gravitational lensing and string theory thing, so I don't know. Anyway.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
Oh. No, we've got. No.
Mm-hmm.
No, we're going to a break. We're going to a break. We've got.
Back to the log-log plot, I was noticing that the one solar mass star, it
yeah.
seemed to hit that electron degeneracy line, and yet the density continued to increase.
Yes.
How does
okay.
that work?
Good. Excellent. This is, as I say, somebody's paying attention. Okay, so one more piece of physics I didn't explain. This is the sun, okay? So here it is, it's burned out of, it's burned its core, just its core has been burned, hydrogen and helium. So when the sun leaves the main sequence, is what we call it, goes off to become a red giant, what's happened is the core has burned out. So you've got a 0.1 solar mass, 10% of the mass is pure helium. It has a pure helium ball at the center.
Okay.
That pure helium ball does contract a bit, and this is the trajectory of that pure helium ball. That's all it's showing you. So you see it contracts, and it actually, you know, it's a little weird, but now this is what you're asking about. Why is this? Okay. That's because that pure helium ball contracts, becomes degenerate, and holds itself up. So I've got now a little object roughly twice the size of the Earth, pure helium. But I've got 9/10 of a solar mass of hydrogen above me. At the surface of that helium ball, I can burn hydrogen. And so it ends up, that's what the star does. It burns hydrogen in a thin shell, and that hydrogen temperature, as a function of time, rises. And that sets, that's a thermostat that communicates to the core. And so this is the temperature rise of the helium core due to the fact that the outer boundary is vigorously burning hydrogen. And you burn another 3/10 of a, actually about a 4/10 of a solar mass. So when you get to here, you now have a helium core that's about half a solar mass. So you burn most of the hydrogen to helium on the, in the red giant phase. Okay? And back, if I went back to the original plot, somewhere here, okay, it's these. These are the red giants. And you burn, you're very luminous. And so you then you have to ask, well, wait a minute, you told us the luminosity goes like the mass cube. Yes, I did. But remember, that was for an ideal gas star. This is not an ideal gas star. Okay? So that's another course. But I'm glad to see, that everybody's, you know, very awake. Coffee obviously works. Yeah.
Where on this yeah. line is it, the red giant?
This is the red giant phase right here.
Okay.
This is the red giant phase. And you see that all these stars below 2.5 actually have the same trajectory. They all collapse onto the same trajectory. And there's this great thing called the helium core flash, which is when that helium ignites. And it's actually quite unstable. And, you know, it's another piece of physics we don't understand. It's a little bit embarrassing. Actually, we're working on it here right now. But there is a flash.
So Betelgeuse right now would be in the stage of burning that hydrogen shell around the helium core. Would that be so?
I don't know what kind of star Betelgeuse is. Ed's raising his hand. He's going to tell me. Okay.
Can...
Right.
Okay. Is there any way we can tell, looking at a star, whether it's past burning the helium, in other words,
yeah.
burning any of the other stages?
It really depends on the mass of the star. So the massive stars, at the very end, the burning gets very accelerated in time. And so if you just ask, you know, randomly to catch it at a random phase in its lifetime, let's say 80% of its lifetime is burning hydrogen. Low mass stars are different. I think there was a question right here. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Right. No. So I can derive for you on the back of the envelope the maximum mass, but I didn't do it. It has to do with the fact that if I get very massive, I'm very hot. Okay? And the radiation temperature, the radiation pressure ends up being the dominant pressure instead of the ideal gas. Trying to be held up, the star wants to be held up by radiation photons. Okay? You try to hold up a star with relativistic particles, you find the binding energy becomes zero. So you all know the Kepler problem, but you've probably never done the relativistic Kepler problem of a particle orbiting with a velocity that's the speed of light. If you do that problem, you'll find that the binding energy and the kinetic energy are equal. So the binding is zero. So you have two big numbers which exactly cancel. Therefore, the star is very susceptible to other stuff breaking it up. It's got a very low binding energy. And if you will, the star has a hard time holding itself together. And that mass is 60 to 80. Maybe Ed can tell us, you know, in his talk. But it's that's what sets it.
Let me just say, these are really good questions, and we're going to be spending some time together today over coffee and lunch. Just wanted to mention to you that if you want to ask Lars about his ongoing research, as he was telling you, you know, this is all still going on, and there are lots of questions unanswered. He's just gotten us to the point of a lot of his ongoing research, because what he likes to do is he likes to consider neutron stars, the end state of a supernova explosion, or the white dwarfs he was telling us about. He likes to see what happens when you put matter on them. What if they have a binary companion that contributes a little bit of mass to them. What's the fate of that mass, and what's the fate of the ultimate system? So maybe over lunch or coffee, you'll have a chance to talk with them about that. We're going to have a change of pace and move over, believe it or not, to an experimental astrophysics topic after coffee. But yeah, this is a lot of material in a short time, so we're going to take a break until 10:30. So let's enjoy some coffee and snacks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yes,
it's
please.
A little question, actually. I've heard that nickel.